Welcome to the Innovation and Technology Management Seminar Series hosted by the Engineering Management Program in the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University.
What I'm talking about today are some of the received wisdom, the core concepts, the heuristics that are used in the financial markets, and the critique of them. What we have in the financial markets is a pretty complex system of hypotheses, assumptions, beliefs. They make up the working framework of how people think about markets. And then we have within that community people who spend their time poking holes in those very same hypotheses and beliefs. And today you can be in that group. You can be with the people who are questioning and challenging these ideas. The deepest and one of the best critiques of this whole framework has been developed by a man named Nassim Taleb. He has a background as a trader. He's run his own hedge fund. He's taught quantitative finance at the NYU quantitative finance program, which is very good. He's a professor at Courant. He's written a number of outstanding books, including two that are of general interest that I highly recommend. One is called Fooled by Randomness, and the other is called The Black Swan. And what I've done here in this presentation is I've created an outline where we can quickly go through some of the core concepts so that you can understand what Nassim Taleb is critiquing. Because if you just read the critique and you don't understand the depth and rigor and effort that has gone into the models, it's easy to just agree with him and say, well, yeah, sure, and not appreciate the both the challenge that those who would critique the status quo face, but also the tremendous intellectual effort that has gone into creating these status quo models. They are perhaps incorrect, but they are not trivial. So I suggest that as we go through this, you try to keep in mind, are the models self-consistent? That is, as if you take the hypotheses of these models as true, do the conclusions follow? And then a very different kind of question, are these models predictive? Does an understanding of these models allow one to have a superior grasp or more realistic expectations about future outcomes? And if the answer to that is no, when is it no? Because it can't be no every single minute of every day, or no one would believe in these models, no one would use them. The challenge is that they tend to work much of the time, or even most of the time, and then when they don't work, they fail in a big way. And then ask yourself, if these models fail in a big way, why are they still relied upon? What social function do they serve? These are a little bit different, you see, than something like a scientific theory. Like when the scientific theory of the ether was destroyed and replaced by a relativistic theory of the speed of light, people just stopped studying the theory of the ether. It became a bunch of dusty textbooks on the back shelf of the library. But that is not what happens in finance. Because in finance, we need working models. We need something to hang on to. And whether this is a psychological need, an economic need, you can decide for yourself. But the situation that we have here is something like if the theory of the ether had been disproved, but no theory of relativity had been created to replace it. And so we had a theory that was not consistent with all the data, but was consistent with much of the data most of the time. What role does a theory like that play? Should it be banished because it's horribly wrong when it's wrong? Or should it be tolerated with a little bit of skepticism, kept a little bit at arm's length? All right. There are three cornerstone ideas in the theory of finance as it's commonly presented today. These are the efficient market hypothesis. How many of you have heard that term? efficient market hypothesis. Okay, 60%. The portfolio theory for managing volatility, how many of you have heard that of that term? Okay, 50%. And then the Black-Scholes theory, the partial differential equation, and the formula for pricing stock options. How many of you have heard of Black-Scholes? Everybody. So everybody's heard of the most arcane and difficult of the three. That's great. The Black-Scholes option pricing theory can be derived from the other two ideas. It's a non-obvious derivation. They won the Nobel Prize for it. But it's helpful to understand these three ideas together. So where does the efficient market hypothesis come from? It comes from a man in France in 1900 named Bachelard, who studied stock prices on the French stock market, and he realized that the prices appeared to move in a random fashion and that it was impossible to predict future performance from the data based on past performance. In other words, stock prices do not have momentum. An upward moving stock does not continue to move upward. There's no continuity in the pricing of stocks whatsoever. And he wrote a dissertation in 1900 and filed it away, and no one really noticed it until the 1930s in the United States, when a man named Alfred Krauss, let me see about the spelling of that. Yeah, Alfred Krauss did a similar study on U.S. stock prices and realized, but he had a different focus. He studied the performance of money managers. And he discovered that money managers did no better than chance in managing stock portfolios. Well, that's a pretty shocking finding when you think how much money people who manage stocks charge their customers. These are people who are living in mansions and sailing in yachts, and you would do just as well flipping a coin to decide what stocks to buy. That was quite a stunning finding. But no one was able to encapsulate that finding in a rigorous form, until a man named Eugene Fama came along. And he wrote a dissertation, which was later published in 1965, called The Behavior of Stock Market Prices. The basic idea of this book is that you cannot predict future prices by looking at past prices. You cannot predict future prices by looking at past prices. What that means is that an entire school of analysis of stock prices upon which purchase decisions and selling decisions were made, and still are made today, if you can believe it, called technical analysis, was disproven. Technical analysis is the study of the shape of the curves made by stocks. You'll sometimes hear people refer to support prices. That's a concept from technical analysis. The price is dropping and supposedly it's going to level off and go up again. Or breaking through a support price. That's the idea that there should be, based on the shape of this curve, some sort of resistance to further drop, and yet the price goes down. Well, that's pretty bearish, obviously. It's all nonsense. It's been profoundly, completely, and utterly disproven. If you choose to engage in technical analysis, enjoy yourselves, but it is completely and utterly pseudoscience. However, Eugene Fama attempted to take his ideas a little farther, and in 1970 he wrote another article that's actually a lot more challenging and interesting, in which he distinguished three different kinds of efficient market hypothesis. Weak form efficiency, which is just what I said. Technical analysis does not work. Okay. However, it might be that there's publicly available information that hasn't been properly analyzed. That if you are thoughtful, perceptive, insightful, experienced, what have you, you could study the publicly available information about a stock, its reports, its prices, information about the economy, trends, and somehow figure out stocks that are undervalued against some pricing model that you have. That's called fundamental analysis. Okay? Under weak form efficiency, fundamental analysis might still work. But semi-strong form efficiency says all the publicly available information has already been priced into the stock. And priced in probabilistically. So if the information tells you that there's a 10% chance of a great event happening and a 1% chance of a bad event happening and so on, that's all averaged into the price. So the price can still move when there's new information, but it will reach an equilibrium point on that new information almost instantaneously. That's what semi-strong form efficiency says. Semi-strong form efficiency says that the only way that you can outperform the market is if you have insider information. You know secrets about the company. Strong form efficiency, which is my favorite, because it's actually pretty intellectually interesting, is the idea that, in fact, the stock already reflects all the insider information as well. There is no movement in the stock price that will be triggered by the further diffusion of insider information out to the public, because insiders, even if they are not allowed to by law, have found a way. They somehow have found a way to buy or sell that stock against that information. Okay. So ever since 1970, people have been crunching the numbers and trying to figure out, is it weak? Is it semi-strong? Is it strong? Well, the answer is, what do you think? How many say strong form? You have to vote. You have to vote for one or the other. Based on what I've said, how many would say strong form? One. Brave soul. One brave soul. How many would say semi-strong? Of course, because it's always the middle of the three things, right? How many would say weak form? Okay. Well, of course, you're right. The academic consensus today is that the market follows semi-strong form efficiency. All right. That's all we have time for on that. Okay. The second idea is a lot more interesting, a lot more influential, and a lot more destructive. It's the idea, something called portfolio theory. It was developed by two people, Harry Markowitz and William Sharp, in the 50s and 60s. And what they said was the following. They said, every stock bounces around in price. Woo, 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 right? Bounces around in price. But stocks do not all bounce around in price together. They're all bouncing in different directions. So while that one's going up, another one's going down. Right? And you can measure, using ordinary regression analysis, you just push a button on Excel, you can measure the correlation between these two sets of movements. Okay? So here is the grand idea of portfolio theory in a nutshell. If you have a lot of highly correlated assets, they'll all go up and down together. Wow, I'm impressed. Hello, you awake? You out there? If I buy a bunch of assets whose volatility is uncorrelated with one another, the aggregate volatility of that group of assets will be much less, probably less than any single asset, and certainly much less than a portfolio constructed any other way. Right? Okay. And if I really am clever, I will include assets that not only are uncorrelated with each other, but they're uncorrelated with the stock market as a whole. Or even better than that, inversely correlated. Are there any company stocks that go up when the market goes down? Anybody? What kind of company might go up when the stock market goes down? Yes, cigarette companies. Alcohol companies, absolutely. Companies that sell very low-priced goods, Walmart. Yes, companies that are in the business of profiting off others' misery will do well in a recession or a depression. So the idea of portfolio theory in a nutshell is, if you hold a bundle of assets that are uncorrelated in their in the way that volatility works, you can generate good returns or great returns with much less overall volatility. Along with this is another idea that seems obvious to me. Is that obvious to everyone? Right, okay. Along with that is a much more subtle and slippery idea and more dangerous idea, which is that risk is equivalent to or equal to volatility. So that if I want to have less risk, I want to have less volatility. And then there's a statement about reality. There's a hypothesis about the real world, which is if I tolerate higher levels of volatility, I can achieve higher returns. This theory is based on a couple basic ideas. The first one is that there's something called a risk-free rate of return. A risk-free rate of return would be the rate of return that would be paid on the safest possible investment you could have. In the United States, this is typically a short-term, highly liquid bond purchased from the U.S. government. The chance that that will not get repaid is close to zero. It's not the same as zero, but it's close enough to zero for practical purposes, right? If there was a huge thermonuclear war in the next 3 days, it might not get paid. But you'll have other things to worry about. So as long as there's a stock market, you'll get repaid. That's the risk-free rate of return. And portfolio theory states that there's a trade-off between higher returns and higher volatility. Okay? What is volatility? Volatility is just the standard deviation from some norm. So this is an extremely simple idea, but it's quite dressed up. And it becomes quite highly, highly influential in money management. Because if I'm a money manager, what I do is I try to acquire stocks that are not all in the same sector, they're not all in the same industry, they're inversely correlated to one another. I look for assets, I look for alternative asset classes that are inversely or non-correlated to the stock market, like what? What would be something that would just be uncorrelated to the stock market? Well, utilities would be a sector of the stock market. Commodities historically have been largely, sometimes they go up together, sometimes they go down together, but they don't seem over long periods of time to be that correlated. Yes, that's a good example. So what we have is a theory for putting together a portfolio that's based on how much risk do you want to take. Well, so the conventional wisdom is, well, you know, you're young, you can take more risk, you should have a portfolio that's weighted to stocks. It has higher volatility, therefore it will have higher returns. Okay. The problem with this theory we'll get into later, but I just want to make sure you understand the theory. The Sharpe ratio is the ratio of additional return over additional risk. So the idea is a well-managed portfolio incrementally increases its return faster than it incrementally increases its risk. Okay? So then we get to the big stuff, Black-Scholes. Black-Scholes was developed in 1973. These were economists who were wrestling with the ideas of portfolio theory. And they said, interesting, stocks move around according to a random walk. That's an axiom or a premise of efficient market, semi-strong, and portfolio theory, right? What is a random walk? Does anyone know? Yes.
It's basically like if you go, if you're here, you can easily go this direction or this direction at equal. There's no like.
Yes, there's no directional bias. It's a description of Brownian motion, which is the motion of molecules in a gas when they're being buffeted by other molecules, and they can run into other molecules of a certain range of momentum that are moving in different directions, and they zig and they zag and they bounce around. That's how molecules move in a gas. It's also how molecules move when they are diffusing. So if you think about it, the way one molecule moves around and the way a group of molecules diffuse is really the same thing. That's Brownian motion. And there's a whole lot of mathematics and thought that's gone into the study of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics about how this works. So these guys thought, wow, there's Brownian motion over there in physics. We have random walk in stock prices. I wonder if we could apply Brownian motion diffusion formulas to the random walk of stock prices. For this, they won the Nobel Prize. Yes, they did. Yes, they did. So, their insight, it's easy to make fun of things, you know. It is impressive. Their insight was that you have two components. You have two components to Brownian motion. You have a component that looks like this. Can people read that? Not a very good pen. See if there's a better one. Okay, much better. All right, there's one that looks like this. Okay, this is the price of a stock. Okay? This is a thing called the drift. What's another name for the drift? The risk-free rate of return. It's a line. It's a linear calculation of the return, expected return of the asset in the absence of randomness, in the absence of Brownian motion. So the change in price of stock is a combination of the drift in the price of the stock over time and a random element. This is the standard deviation, or the volatility. This is a standard deviation, which equals the volatility, which equals the risk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing, stock price. Okay, DT, WT. What the hell is WT? Well, WT is the Brownian or stochastic component. So this is a very concise way. Is DT, STT, WT? Yes. This is a very concise way of saying that over time, stocks move the way we expected them to, plus they move randomly. Geniuses. All right. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is, yes, stock prices do sort of kind of move like molecules in Brownian motion. Kind of, sort of, yeah, they kind of, sort of do. If you take the drift out, well, what's the drift? Well, that's how they're moving that isn't Brownian motion. They move like Brownian and then something else. So, okay, so we can recombine those two, and you can come up with a formula that reflects the value of the right to sell this stock at a certain time in the future at a certain known price. Okay? And that turns out to be very, very useful. Very, very useful information. Because let's say you have a stock. You have a stock. It's going up. Okay? our expectation, this is our expectation, this is our drift, right? It's also bouncing around randomly. This cone of randomness is getting wider and wider and wider and wider, right? At some future time, this cone of randomness is huge, but the outside perimeter of that cone of randomness are very, very rare events. That would be like in Brownian motion of the molecule, you went zing and zipped over to the far side of the room, right? Instead, most of the motion cancels itself out. So if you looked at the frequency of occurrence of these events, it would look something like this. You'd have a few events out at the fringe, tons of events nearer to the line, and they'd thin out as you get farther away from the line. Something like that. Okay? Well, how do you put one price on the right to sell the asset at some future point at some pre-agreed price, which could be here, it could be here, it could be anywhere in there? Well, gosh, that's not obvious. That's not obvious. And what Black and Scholes did is they came up with a formula based on this for calculating the value of the right to sell a stock at any price in that range at any time in the future. And all you need to know is what? What? Well, yeah, you need to know the drift, but what else do you need to know? That would be the drift. What else do you need to know? Well, you need to know how hot the gas is. You need to know how much kinetic energy it has. What would that translate to in finance terms? How volatile it is. How volatile is it? If it's an asset that historically over time barely moves from its drift, that's obviously a stock option that's worth something very different than one that goes woohoo. Okay? So you have to have historical data to plug into your formula. You have to have data for your drift and data for your volatility. So if you have those two things, you have, okay, the part that we cancel out that we don't have in Brownian motion, and then we have like the initial kinetic energy, the initial momentum of the molecule, and then we have how much it's bouncing around, which is equivalent to the kinetic energy of the gas, pressure of the gas. Well, you have something. And that something can win you the Nobel Prize. Okay. Now we're going to talk about the objections. So that's it. That's the grand framework of finance theory. For this, people earn millions of dollars and drive very nice cars and buy second houses in Nantucket and stuff. Incredible, huh? I mean, you learn more in first year engineering school than a PhD in this learns, right? Of course you do. Of course you do. Okay? All right. When does reality not correspond to the efficient market hypothesis? Well, in a crash. In a crash, it doesn't correlate. Why not? Well, for one thing, the efficient market hypothesis assumes that stock prices are continuous. But in fact, stock prices are discrete. You sell a stock at $25, the market is crashing, you may not be able to sell again until it's at $15. You can't sell in 1/1000th of a second at $24.75. You can sell in 2 minutes at $10. You get it? You can think of it as like quanta. It's quantized. You can't sell a stock at every continuous fractional price. Okay? It is not a continuous line. Okay. What that means is that when new information arrives, there's no way that the market can instantaneously, it can quickly adjust, but it cannot instantaneously adjust. Okay. Then there's this interesting psychology factor, which is the semi-strong theory implies that the knowledge of fundamental analysis is the primary thing that's priced into a stock. It doesn't say it, but it implies it. Oh, good companies have higher stock values, but what happens when you start second-guessing other people and you say, well, I know that's a dog. I know that eToys is hopeless, but everyone else doesn't realize how hopeless it really is yet. and they're excited about buying it. So even though eventually it's going to go bankrupt, it's going to double before it goes bankrupt. So I'm going to buy it on the expectation that bigger fools will pay more later. Okay? This is how bubbles get going. And then the bigger fools say, I was right, it did go up, I'll buy more. And so on and so forth. Until all of a sudden people say, it's a tulip bulb. It can't be worth as much as Holland. It's a tulip. They come to their senses, they bail, prices crash again. That's a bubble. That's a bubble. And interestingly, when we had this dot-com bubble, everyone knew it was a bubble. I knew it was a bubble, my friends knew it was a bubble, everyone knew it was a bubble. It's a bubble. These prices are based on nothing. And nevertheless, we were buying stocks because they're going to go up. And usually we were right, you know, for quite a while. Then when we were wrong, we were horribly wrong, but we were right for quite some time. Okay. This is compounded by the fact that human psychology is not based on rational assessment and probabilistic calculation of risk. I mean, a great example of this is most people are more frightened of sharks and snakes than they are of heart disease. But they're like 1,000,000,000 times more likely to die of a heart attack than to get eaten by a shark. People's fears are deeply rooted in us. They have to do with our evolutionary history. And it's no different with the stock market or anything else. People's reaction to information is driven by their psychology. It used to be that economics was dominated by the theory that each individual is a rational utility optimizer. But all of this recent history has demonstrated to most people's satisfaction that there's got to be more to it. And the leader in this understanding of the unpredictability of human nature is a man named Daniel Kahneman, who's at the Woodrow Wilson School of Princeton, who won the Nobel Prize. His first job as a psychologist was assessing the leadership qualities of candidates for officer training in the Israeli army. And he started to get the feeling that the way people behave under stress can be quite unpredictable. You can't always judge by the resume who's going to be a good officer when the bullets start flying. And I have a quote of his. Let me see if I can find that. Yes, I'm going to read you a little quote of Daniel Kahneman's. So when he was a boy growing up, he was Jewish. He was growing up in Nazi-occupied France. He was a little boy. He was out after curfew one night. I'll read you the story. He said, it was early 1942. Jews were required to wear the Star of David and obey a 6 p.m. curfew. I had gone to play with a Christian friend and had stayed too late. I turned my brown sweater inside out to hide the star and walked a few blocks home. As I was walking down an empty street, I saw a German soldier approaching. He was wearing the black uniform that I had been told to fear more than others, the one worn by specially recruited members of the SS. As I came closer to him, trying to walk fast, I noticed that he was looking at me intently. Then he beckoned me over, picked me up, and hugged me. I was terrified that he would notice the star inside my sweater. He was speaking to me with great emotion, in German. When he put me down, he opened his wallet and showed me a picture of a boy and gave me some money. I went home more certain than ever that my mother was right. People were endlessly complicated and interesting. Behavioral economics is the study of the way people really are, the way we really make decisions under stress. And it turns out to be endlessly complicated and interesting. The final objection to the official market hypothesis is, well, what about people who are beating the market? How can they beat the market consistently? It wouldn't seem possible under laws of chance that Warren Buffett would beat the market averages 19 out of 20 years for the last 20 years. Or that someone like David Swensen, the portfolio manager at Yale, would be able to generate 30%+ returns year after year after year after year with all the same basic information and access to investments as every other money manager. Well, there are some defenses of the efficient market hypothesis that you could make. For example, you could point out that Warren Buffett runs an insurance company that has special tax status, that he lobbied the legislature in Omaha to allow his insurance company to buy equities when every other insurance company in the United States is limited to buying bonds, so that he gets the benefit of equities and the special tax status of an insurance company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or that Swenson, half the people who manage hedge funds in New York went to Yale, and he knows them and he's friends with them, and they give him access to things that other people don't have. Okay? Well, you'll have to decide for yourself. It does appear that certain individuals do seem to buy and sell publicly traded securities and do a little bit better than average or random. But very, very, very few. Very, very few. If you look at the top performing mutual funds in the United States each year, according to Morningstar ratings, the next year their distribution of their performance is random. There is no year-to-year correlation of performance of mutual funds whatsoever. Buy an index fund. If you want to be invested in equities, buy an index fund. Why are you paying 1 or 2% a year plus transaction costs plus taxes? Makes no sense whatsoever. It's pseudoscience. It's been disproved. People do it anyway. All right. What are the primary objections to portfolio theory? Well, again, it assumes continuous pricing, real-world pricing is discrete. But it's much more dramatic here, because here you have the phenomenon that's called a liquidity hole. A liquidity hole does not mean that prices are dropping. It means there is nowhere to trade. Right? A great example of this is the Russian Stock Exchange when the Bolsheviks came to power. Well, the Russian Stock Exchange between 1914 and 1917 was up about 35-40%. Things were booming. Stocks were up until the very day the Bolsheviks came and locked the stock exchange, and every stock on the exchange became worthless. Why did it become worthless? Because you could not trade them at any price. No liquidity. They didn't have any more records of future prices. It wasn't like a crash. It just stopped. And this, yes, it just stopped. That's it. No more trades. Okay? This is what's happening now, right now, right now, in the mortgage-backed securities market. There are no trades. So if you wonder what the hell's going on Wall Street, people have these things called auction price securities. The pricing is supposed to happen in an auction. Well, that's great because I get the real world market price, right? And then I have the right under my contract to sell my market-based securities at the auction price at each auction. And the auctions are held every 2 weeks. So what could be more liquid than that? So here's what happens. There's a few $100 billion of these auction-based securities. They have the auction, and no one shows up to bid at any price. So I say, well, I want $200 million for my bond, but I'd take $180 million. No, I'd take that back. I'd take $150 million. No. I'd take $100 million. I've got to get out of this thing. I'm Bear Stearns. I'm going bankrupt. And there's no one to bid at any price. So Bear Stearns stock, because they held many hundreds of millions of dollars of these. Bear Stearns per stock, because, oh, and by the way, the money that they owe people, they have to pay now. They can't say, but I'll pay you when I can sell my auction-based securities. No. Bear Stearns was leveraged 30-1 to buy auction-based securities. Okay? What that means is that if the value of auction-based securities goes down 3 1/3%, they've wiped out their entire net worth. But it's worse than that. It's worse than that. They just assumed, well, it doesn't matter if the price goes down or not because we can always just roll them over. We can just borrow more money until the price goes up again. They didn't even contemplate that there'd be no auction. It's just like the Bolsheviks. They took the stock market away. So that's what you're dealing with. A liquidity hole. That's what we have now. There's no sale at any price. So how do you mark that to market? I don't know. It's worth more than zero, but not a whole lot more today. It doesn't solve my problem. I'm going bankrupt, right? And this is something that happened with long-term capital management. How many of you heard of long-term capital management? Do you know who founded long-term capital management? Myron Scholes, the very one and the same. The guy who came up with the theory. What happened to long-term capital management was they had a very reasonable bet that if you were in two separate markets with different bond prices, the prices would tend to arbitrage together. so that you could hedge one against the other and eventually the prices will converge. Absolutely correct. The problem is that they got leveraged, hugely leveraged. And there were some weird things happened in the world. There were some defaults in the third world. And prices diverged. Well, okay, that's fine. They'll come back together eventually. And they did. In the meantime, long-term capital management went bankrupt and lost all its equity because they couldn't borrow enough to, they couldn't roll over their debt. They couldn't borrow enough to sustain themselves. And this is something that Keynes, who was a very famous economist in the early part of the 20th century, said. He said, markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. They forgot about that. Okay. Okay. The other assumption is that individual pricing events are largely uncorrelated. In other words, you remember how we said there's a correlated component that things track to the market, and then there's an uncorrelated component, they're orthogonal. Right? Just using regression analysis. Two stocks are 50% correlated. The other 50% is uncorrelated. Okay? Well, what happens is people make a lot of assumptions about value based on the idea that the proportion of correlated to uncorrelated risk is constant. Well, guess what? It is not. And as Nassim Taleb says, everything correlates in a crash. Everything correlates in a crash. Everything's going down. It's dropping like a brick. You don't have the nice uncorrelated asset to turn to. Great example of this, again, is the mortgage-backed securities market. People said, well, we'll buy some mortgages in Texas and some in Ohio and some in New Jersey and some in California, and some will be big houses and some are small houses and some are good creditors and some are bad creditors, and it'll be fine because we'll mix all those risks together. They can't all go default at the same time. Right? Historically, there have never been default rates of more than about 2% at any one time in the United States. Okay. Well, what people didn't take into account is that a very large percentage of these mortgages were written as interest-only mortgages for a limited number of years, typically 4 years. So, for example, we'll do simple math. Let's say you have a 6% interest rate, you buy a $100,000 house, you pay $6,000 a year. That's $500 a month the first 4 years. Then, in year five, you start paying back principal over 10 years. So now you have to pay $10,000 plus $6,000. So now your monthly payment is over $1,000 a month. Well, all those mortgages came due at the same time. They all hit their cliffs at the same time. The assumption had been, oh, when we get there, we'll just refinance them. Based on the idea that there's no such thing as a liquidity hole. You cannot refinance these mortgages at any price. You can't get an interest-only loan at any price. It doesn't matter how good your credit is. The banks can't even borrow money right now. So what happens is everything correlates in a crash, and the idea that you can insulate yourself from market forces by buying assets that most of the time in the past appear to have an uncorrelated component to their pricing is a fallacy. A dangerous fallacy. All right. Well, the first obvious objection to the Black-Scholes option pricing model is that's not what options cost. What do you mean that's not what options cost? No. If Black-Scholes tells you that based on the known prior volatility of a stock, an option to sell that stock at a certain price in for the next 6 months in the future is worth $100, the actual market price will be more like $110 to $150. Well, what is it that the market knows that the Black-Scholes model doesn't know? Do they know that volatility is itself volatile? What do they know? What do they know? Well, it's not exactly clear what they know. It's not exactly clear what accounts for the difference in price. But ever since the Black-Scholes model has existed, the actual price of options has been significantly higher. That has never really varied. Exactly how much higher has varied. So right there's something going on. Okay, then the Black-Scholes model, right in the model, says, well, there are no transaction costs. Because in order for it to work, you have to be able to hedge your option at any time by buying or selling the underlying. The underlying is the fancy finance name for the stock against which you have this derivative, this option to buy or sell. Okay. Then, the volatility that's plugged into the formula, this thing, sigma, constant. You say, well, over the past 5 years, the volatility has been X. The deviance from some line, some drift line, has been 20%. Well, volatility itself is volatile. That is not accounted for in the model. Okay? Interestingly, that was already known in 1973. Because Benoit Mandelbrot, who you probably have heard of him because he discovered or invented fractals. How many of you heard of fractals? Right, okay, well, fractals are beautiful and interesting, but his real accomplishment was in realizing that commodity prices have a curve, a distribution, that is not a bell-shaped curve. Everybody knows what a bell looks like? You can superimpose a bell onto this, right? There's lots and lots of events. Lots and lots of events near the middle, and very few events out on the fringe, right? So we have a curve. We have a curve here which is bell-shaped. It's actually called a Gaussian bell-shaped curve. We have a diffusion of that curve over time, but the shape of the curve is constant. Well, guess what? Benoit Mandelbrot showed that cotton prices, once they became volatile, once they started to swing to extremes, they tended to swing a lot more. That the actual shape of this curve is more like this. Okay? These are called fat tails. Have you heard the expression of fat tail? Anybody? Yes? Did you ever wonder what a fat tail was? A fat tail is, if you want to show off at cocktail parties, you can say, yes, the deviance from the Poisson Gaussian distribution was anomalous. Try it. See how it goes. That'll shut people up. All right. So these are some of the problems with these theories. Right? Have we left them in a bloody heap on the floor? Have we destroyed them yet? Well, no. As a matter of fact, we haven't. They remain incredibly influential and important. And almost any option that's sold will have its Black-Scholes price there somewhere on the computer monitor for you to see. Okay. But Nassim Taleb, I think, has done the best and deepest job of critiquing this whole worldview. This whole worldview. He's taken it on from the beginning. And what he has pointed out in different ways, in Fooled by Randomness and The Black Swan, is that we tell ourselves stories about why the past happened the way it did that provide narrative structure and logic retroactively to events that at the time were random and completely unpredictable. So now we can say that it's inevitable that the Allies would win World War II. It's obvious. At the time, it was touch and go. It was obvious the United States would win the Cold War. Russia was just a paper tiger. Their whole country was falling apart. Not so. It was extremely not obvious at the time. I can tell you, having lived through it, it was extremely not clear how that was going to turn out. What we have is a world in which people crave a coherent explanation. And events keep coming along that smash our prior expectations. So, for example, the collapse of the Soviet Union was completely, totally unpredicted by every intelligence service of every Western country. There's nobody who predicted it. Nobody. Nobody. It just shocked everybody to pieces. And yet there were thousands of people whose entire job was to monitor the Soviet Union, gather every scrap of information about it, dissect it and predict what was going to happen. The Black Swan is the event. But now, you go to any library, any bookstore, there are hundreds of books explaining how inevitable it was that the Soviet Union would collapse. And they're very convincing and persuasive. You read them, like, oh my goodness, rotten to the core. Yeah. And we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, that then people will write 100 books about that. explaining how obvious it was and how certain it was. Okay, I can tell you an example from my own personal experience. I was involved in the search engine market, and the concept of filtering your search results by using inbound links to do priority ranking was one that I was very interested in, and I filed some patents on it and so on. And absolutely none of the search engines, Yahoo, Google, Excite, Lycos, Infoseek, etc., had the slightest interest in it. And I ran out of money, I sold the company, I did something else, I bought the patents back. It's a long story. But 2 years later, Google came and made the exact same pitch. They said, guys, the internet's too big. Graham Spencer, the founder of Excite, said to me in 1996, for your technology to be useful, there'd have to be 1 billion web pages. That could take decades. All right? Well, there were 1 billion web pages by 2000. Okay? But it was inconceivable to one of the optimistic visionaries of the internet who had founded one of the first search companies in 1994. It was invisible to the believers how huge it was going to be. And nobody would invest in Google. You know, they finally scraped together $100,000 from Andy Bechtolsheim, one of the founders of Sun, and that was enough to build their first prototype. And, you know, all the search engine companies turned them down flat. So the point is, we have a mindset where we want the future to make sense. We want to impose narrative structure on it. The future is inherently unpredictable. One of the ways in which the future is unpredictable that is highly relevant to you because you are involved in technology and business is one of the themes of Nassim Taleb's work, which is that the technology inventions and their impact on markets are unpredictable. Why are they unpredictable? Well, because if we could predict them, we would have already invented them. We cannot predict what we will discover to be true that we do not know today. By definition, we cannot. We would already know it. So we could predict that we'll have flying cars or telepathy or what have you, but we could not predict that the iPhone would be as powerful as a supercomputer was in 1970, and a lot better looking, and a lot easier to put in your pocket, right? And by the way, it won't cost $5 million, it will cost $500. You're kidding me. That's absurd. That's preposterous. That is preposterous. If you told someone in 1970, I have a 30 gigabyte hard drive on my iPhone, you're kidding me. When I started in the software business, this shows how old I am, it was 1992. Someone told me, well, you'll never be able to build the kind of search engine technology you're talking about because the maximum storage capacity in any media is the size of a CD-ROM, which is 650 megabytes. That's it. You know, that's it. That's the maximum. And it's true. There was not a hard drive you could buy that had more than 650 megabytes of storage capacity. Okay? Well, now you carry around a 30-gigabyte hard drive in your pocket. Right? You don't even need a hard drive. It's much better technology. It's solid-state technology. So inherently, the future of technology is unpredictable. Okay? And then we have the Luddick fallacy, which is that between two kinds of analyses of the future, it is our human psychology that a certain kind will always win out. And this kind of narrative that will win out is what Nassim Taleb calls a Luddick narrative. It's one that is, he uses words like, it is palpable, it is embedded, it is authoritative, it is vivid, it is persuasive, it is gripping, it is intuitive. It's just wrong. But it plays to all of our emotions. You know, a great example of this in recent U.S. history was the whole case that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. It was absurd. However, it formed a very gripping and persuasive narrative. It was a story that made sense, except it was false. Okay, and on that basis, hideous lives and treasure were squandered. But But the alternative story, which is, well, you know, the sanctions are kind of working, and he's not as much of a threat. He still hates us, but he really doesn't have any money anymore. And that just wasn't a story anybody could get excited about. The New York Times couldn't even get excited about it. Right? They're supposedly the paper of the opposition. They got completely pulled into the whole chemical weapons, Judith Miller thing. Okay? It's irresistible. A good story is irresistible. Okay? Nassim Taleb's basic concept, and you should read these books. These are wonderful books, all three of them. But the second two are written for a popular audience, is that we will always have events that are prior narrative ways of understanding the world cannot predict. Either they are random, or they are utterly, completely unexpected. They come from a completely outlandish direction that we never anticipated as part of our narrative frame. And that as a result of this, the professions that consist of making rational, calculated judgments about the future are largely fatuous and fraudulent and ridiculous. Mostly. But not 100%, because you still need to make decisions in this world. So somehow you have to say, I don't know the future, but I'm going to make a decision in uncertainty, knowing that I'm facing probabilities, knowing that I'm facing randomness, but I'm going to do it knowingly. Knowingly. Right? So this is the challenge. Can we, as financial managers, as people who work in the technology industry, can we commit tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of resources knowing that events, future events, may cause it all for it to be for naught? But that the alternative, which is to do nothing, is completely unacceptable. And not to be taken in by the strength of our own narrative. You know? Let's not drink our own Kool-Aid. Let's not be hypnotized by the mottos or jingles or slogans of our mission statement. All right. That's everything I have for today. Thank you very much.
Let's take a couple of questions. So we'll probably get out the reception pretty quickly, but a couple of questions. And then I'm sure Daniel...
I'm sorry. That was about as fast as I could get through.
That was great. Actually, I'll start while they're warming up. With this idea of the black swan, does that mean that you can't minimize those types of risk with a portfolio? Or is there still a way to minimize those risks? Because as managers, as technology managers, if we're going to go ahead and make these bets, even knowing that these unpredictable events can occur or the technology invention is unpredictable, how do we manage that risk?
Yeah, so what Nassim Taleb says is that we under-hedge by a factor of 10.
Okay.
So, for example, it would have been possible to short mortgage-backed securities, right? It would have been possible to hedge the risk of the collapse of that market. But people just didn't do it because they just assumed that everything was going along great. Nassim Taleb calls this picking up nickels in front of the steamroller. It's all great. I have a friend, quick story. He's an architect. Why is he an architect when he was an investment banker? Well, he was in Russia trading bonds. He's extremely successful, making a lot of money. He spoke fluent Russian. He'd worked at the Rand Corporation. You know, he had all the resume and everything. And telling his clients to buy these bonds are great. One day, the Russian government said, oh, oops, we're not going to pay anymore. We're defaulting. And he lost $120 million of his clients' money in one day and was basically escorted by security guards to the door. And this happens at Wall Street all the time. You're a master of the universe one day, and the next day they've changed your passcode, and you're in the parking lot with a cardboard box full of your stuff. Okay? That is because people devote their career to picking up nickels in front of the steamroller.
No. Other questions?
You said at the beginning that momentum strategies and technical analysis are not, shouldn't work at all.
Yes.
Banks and financial institutions today actually do have large departments.
Yes, that's correct. That is true. They do. They hire technical analysts. And yes, absolutely true. Yes, because the clients insist on it. Yes. Yes?
Louder.
You said that Warren Buffett is just a lucky guy?
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all. I said that the efficient market theorists would defend themselves against the claim that Warren Buffett disproves their theory by arguing that he has some special advantages, some informational advantages, and he has something called the Buffett effect. The Buffett effect is that when Warren Buffett buys something and announces that he has bought it, it goes up in price. And I saw this with my own eyes because he bought a bankrupt asset. He acquired the secured creditor position. In other words, he acquired the debt position on a bankrupt company. And the equity went up 40%.
You're talking about after he became successful, but
yes.
He became successful, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm not defending the efficient market hypothesis. I'm just giving you the arguments on both sides. I personally think the efficient market hypothesis is not correct. But what I think doesn't matter. You need to decide for yourselves. Yes?
Do the lessons you learned by the fiasco of long-term capital management still apply to these markets?
Well, they apply, but people don't learn them. The lesson is, if you're dealing with an asset whose volatility can change with time, don't acquire leverage, don't borrow money based on volatility being constant. Because you'll face something what's called gambler's ruin. Gambler's ruin is when you are right. You have the odds are in your favor, but you run out of money before you can realize your advantage. And it's very easy. Gambler's ruin can happen with very small incremental losses at the beginning. And that's what happened to them. Gambler's ruin. The positions that long-term capital management had to liquidate at huge losses ultimately were profitable. They just couldn't last because they borrowed. Yes? You know, that's a great question. I've asked myself that because the U.S., basically the data is the French, British, and U.S. markets. And you can make a lot of arguments about why those markets were protected. They had special conditions. They had advantages because there weren't markets in other places. They had a certain regulatory environment. I mean, you could say that there were a lot of exceptional things about those markets that would not apply elsewhere. And to my knowledge, there have not been rigorous studies going back decades in other markets. Although I'm sure that as these markets get bigger and there's more and more data, more and more research like this will get done. But this is an area that's very interesting to me. Yeah. Great question.
So we should probably end there. One last question. Aren't you ignoring the black swan theory by being an entrepreneur?
Yes. Absolutely. The nature of being an entrepreneur is that you are shooting at a target that has not arrived yet. It takes 2 or 3 years to develop a product, bring it to market. So it's like I have this gun, and I'm shooting it over there, and you say, what are you shooting at? And I say, in 3 years, an elephant is going to walk by. And a lot of things could happen in the meantime, and do.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.